And it turns out that light eyes don't react very well when you turn down their gifts. The others waited for more, but Kaladin fell silent, working on his reeds. It shocked him how painful it still was to remember those events back in Amaram's army. Either the others sensed his mood or they felt what he'd said was enough, for they each turned back to their work and prodded no further. XXIV. The Gallery of Maps. Neither point makes the things I have written to you here untrue. The king's gallery of maps balanced beauty and function. The expansive domed structure of soul-cast stone had smooth sides that melded seamlessly with the rocky ground. It was shaped like a long loaf of Thalen bread, and had large skylights in the ceiling allowing the sun to shine down on handsome formations of shale bark. Dalinar passed one of these, pinks and vibrant greens and blues, growing in a gnarled pattern as high as his shoulders. The crusty, hard plants had no true stalks or leaves, just waving tendrils, like colorful hair. Except for those, shale bark seemed more rock than vegetation. And yet scholars said it must be a plant for the way it grew and reached toward the light. Men did that too, he thought. Once. High Prince Royan stood in front of one of the maps, hands clasped behind his back, his numerous attendants clogging the other side of the gallery. Royan was a tall, light-skinned man, with a dark, well-trimmed beard. He was thinning on top. Like most of the others, he wore a short, open-fronted jacket exposing the shirt underneath. Its red fabric poked out above the jacket's collar. So sloppy, Dalinar thought, though it was very fashionable. Dalinar just wished that current fashion weren't so, well, sloppy.
Bright Lord Dalinar, Royan said, I have difficulty seeing the point of this meeting.
Walk with me, Bright Lord Royan, Dalinar said, nodding to the side. The other man sighed but joined Dalinar and walked the pathway between the clusters of plants and the wall of maps. Royan's attendants followed. They included both a cupbearer and a shield-bearer. Each map was illuminated by diamonds, their enclosures made of mirror-polished steel. The maps were inked, in detail, onto unnaturally large, seamless sheets of parchment. Such parchment was obviously soul-cast. Near the center of the chamber they came to the prime map, an enormous, detailed map, fixed in a frame on the wall. It showed the entirety of the shattered plains that had been explored. Permanent bridges were drawn in red, and plateaus close to the Alethi side had blue glyph pairs on them, indicating which High Prince controlled them. The eastern section of the map grew less detailed until the lines vanished. In the middle was the contested area, the section of plateaus where the chasm fiends most often came to make their chrysalises. Few came to the near side where the permanent bridges were. If they did come, it was to hunt, not to pupate. Controlling the nearby plateaus was still important, as a high prince, by agreement, could not cross a plateau maintained by one of the others unless he had permission. That determined who had the best pathways to the central plateaus, and it also determined who had to maintain the watchposts and permanent bridges on that plateau. Those plateaus were bought and sold among the high princes. A second sheet of parchment to the side of the prime map listed each high prince and the number of gem hearts he had won. It was a very Alethi thing to do, maintain motivation by making it very clear who was winning and who lagged behind. Royan's eyes immediately went to his own name on the list. Of all the high princes, Royan had won the fewest gem hearts. Dalinar reached his hand up to the prime map, brushing the parchment. The middle plateaus were named or numbered for ease of reference. Foremost of them was a large plateau that stood defiantly near the Parshendi side. The Tower, it was called. An unusually massive and oddly shaped plateau that the chasm fiends seemed particularly fond of using as a spot for pupating. Looking at it gave him pause. The size of a contested plateau determined the number of troops you could field on it. The Parshenda usually brought a large force to the tower, and they have rebuffed the Alethi assaults there 27 times now. No Alethi had ever won a skirmish upon it. Dalinar had been turned back there twice himself. It was just too close to the Parshendi. They could always get there first, and from up, using the slope to give them excellent high ground. But if we could corner them there, he thought, with a large enough force of our own, it could mean trapping and killing a huge number of Parshendi troops, maybe enough of them to break their ability to wage war on the plains. It was something to consider. Before that could happen, however, Dalinar would need alliances. He ran his fingers westward. "High Prince Sarius has been doing very well lately," Dalinar tapped Sarius's war camp. "He's been buying plateaus from other High Princes, making it easier and easier for him to get to the battlefields first."
"Yes," Royon said, frowning. "One hardly needs to see a map to know that, Dalinar."
"Look at the scope of it," Dalinar said. 6 years of continuous fighting and nobody has even seen the center of the Shattered Plains."
"That's never been the point. We hold them in, besiege them, starve them out, and force them to come to us. Wasn't that your plan?"
"Yes, but I never imagined it would take this long. I've been thinking that it might be time to change tactics."
"Why? This one works. Hardly a week goes by without a couple of clashes with the Parshendi. Though I might point out that you have hardly been a model of inspiration in battle lately."
He nodded to Dalinar's name on the smaller sheet. There were a good number of scratches next to his name, noting Gemhart's one, but very few of them were fresh.
"There are some who say the Blackthorn has lost his sting," Royon said.
He was careful not to insult Dalinar outright, but he went further than he once would have. News of Dalinar's actions, while trapped in the barrack, had spread. Dalinar forced himself to be calm.
"Royon, we cannot continue to treat this war as a game." "All wars are games. The greatest kind. With the pieces lost, real lives. The prizes captured, making for real wealth. This is the life for which men exist. To fight, to kill, to win."
He was quoting the Sunmaker, the last Alethi king to unite the High Princes. Gavilar had once revered his name.
"Perhaps," Dalinar said. "Yet what is the point? We fight to get shard blades, then use those shard blades to fight to get more shard blades. It's a circle. Round and round we go, chasing our tails so we can be better at chasing our tails." "We fight to prepare ourselves to reclaim heaven and take back what is ours."
"Men can train without going to war, and men can fight without it being meaningless. It wasn't always this way. There were times when our wars meant something." Royon raised an eyebrow.
"You're almost making me believe the rumors, Dalinar. They say you've lost your taste for combat, that you no longer have the will to fight."
He eyed Dalinar again.
"Some are saying that it is time to abdicate in favor of your son."
"The rumors are wrong," Dalinar snapped.
"That is, they are wrong,"
Dalinar said firmly, "if they claim that I no longer care." He rested his fingers on the surface of the map again, running them across the smooth parchment.
"I care, Royon. I care deeply. About this people, about my nephew, about the future of this war. And that is why I suggest we pursue suggesting an aggressive course from now on." "Well, that is good to hear, I suppose."
"Unite them."
"I want you to try a joint plateau assault with me," Dalinar said.
"What?"
"I want the two of us to try coordinating our efforts and attack at the same time, working together."
"Why would we want to do that?"
"We could increase our chances of winning gem hearts."
"If more troops increased my chances of winning," Royon said, "then I'd just bring more of my own. The plateaus are too small for fielding large armies, and mobility is more important than sheer numbers."
It was a valid point. On the plains, more didn't necessarily mean better. Close confines and a requisite forced march to the battlefield changed warfare significantly. The exact number of troops used depended on the size of the plateau and the High Prince's personal martial philosophy.
Working together wouldn't just be about fielding more troops, Dalinar said. Each High Prince's army has different strengths. I'm known for my heavy infantry. You have the best archers. Sadius's bridges are the fastest. Working together, we could try new tactics. We expend too much effort getting to the plateau in haste. If we weren't so rushed, competing against one another, maybe we could surround the plateau. We could try letting the Parshendi arrive first, then assault them on our terms, not theirs.
Royon hesitated. Dalinar had spent several days deliberating with his generals about the possibility of a joint assault. It seemed that there would be distinct advantages, but they wouldn't know for certain until someone tried it with him. He actually seemed to be considering.
Who would get the gem heart?
We split the wealth equally, Dalinar said.
And if we capture a shard blade?
The man who won it would get it, obviously.
And that's most likely to be you, Royon said, frowning. As you and your son already have shards.
It was the great problem of shard blades and shard plate. Winning either was highly unlikely unless you already had shards yourself. In fact, having only one or the other often wasn't enough. Sadius had faced Parshendi shardbearers on the field, and had always been forced to retreat, lest he be slain himself.
I'm certain we could arrange something more equitable, Dalimar finally said.
If he won shards, he'd been hoping to be able to give them to Renarin.
I'm sure, Royon said skeptically.
Dalinar drew in a breath. He needed to be bolder.
What if I offer them to you? Excuse me?
We try a joint attack. If I win a shard blade or plate, you get the first set. But I keep the second. Royon's eyes narrowed.
You'd do that?
On my honor, Royon.
Well, nobody would doubt that. But can you blame a man for being wary?
Of what?
I am a High Prince, Dalinar, Royon said. My princedom is the smallest, true, but I am my own man. I would not see myself subordinated to someone greater.
You've already become part of something greater, Dalinar thought with frustration. That happened the moment you swore fealty to Gavilar. Royon and the others refused to make good on their promises.
Our kingdom can be so much more than it is, Royon. Perhaps. But perhaps I'm satisfied with what I have. Either way, you make an interesting proposal. I shall have to think on it further.
Very well, Dalinar said. But his instinct said that Royon would decline the offer. The man was too suspicious. The High Princes barely trusted one another enough to work together when there weren't shard blades and gems at stake.
Will I be seeing you at the feast this evening? Royon asked.
Why wouldn't you? Dalinar asked with a sigh.
Well, the Storm Wardens have been saying that there could be a high storm tonight. You see,
I will be there, Dalinar said flatly.
Yes, of course, Royon said, chuckling. No reason why you wouldn't be.
He smiled at Dalinar and withdrew, his attendants following. Dalinar sighed, turning to study the prime map, thinking through the meeting and what it meant. He stood there for a long time, looking down on the plains as if a god far above. The plateaus looked like close islands, or perhaps jagged pieces set in a massive stained glass window. Not for the first time he felt as if he should be able to make out a pattern to the plateaus. If he could see more of them, perhaps. What would it mean if there was an order to the chasms? Everybody else was so concerned with looking strong, with proving themselves. Was he really the only one who saw how frivolous that was? Strength for strength's sake? What good was strength unless you did something with it? Alethkar was a light once, he thought. That's what Gavilar's book claims. That's what the visions are showing me.
Noadon was king of Alethkar so long ago, in the time before the heralds left.
Dalinar felt as if he could almost see it. The secret. The thing that had made Gavilar so excited in the months before his death. If Dalinar could just stretch a little farther, he'd make it out. See the pattern in the lives of men. And finally know. But that was what he'd been doing for the last 6 years. Grasping, stretching, reaching just a little farther. The farther he reached, the more distant those answers seemed to become. Adolin stepped into the gallery of maps. His father was still there, standing alone. Two members of the Cobalt Guard watched over him from a distance. Royon was nowhere to be seen. Adolin approached slowly. His father had that look in his eyes, the absent one he got so often lately. Even when he wasn't having an episode, he wasn't entirely here. Not in the way he once had been. "Father?" Adolin said, stepping up to him.
"Hello, Adolin."
"How was the meeting with Royon?" Adolin asked, trying to sound cheerful.
"Disappointing. I'm proving far worse at diplomacy than I once was at war-making.
There's no profit in peace."
"That's what everyone says. But we had peace once, and seemed to do just fine. Better, even."
"There hasn't been peace since the Tranquiline Halls," Adolin said immediately. "Man's life on Roshar is conflict." It was a quotation from The Arguments. Dalinar turned to Adolin, looking amused.
"Quoting scripture at me? You?"
Adolin shrugged, feeling foolish.
"Well, you see, Malasha is rather religious, and so earlier today I was listening to—"
"Wait," Dalinar said. "Malasha? Who's that?"
"Daughter of Bright Lord Sevix." "And that other girl? Yanala?"
Adolin grimaced, thinking back to the disastrous walk they'd gone on the other day. Several nice gifts had yet to repair that. She didn't seem half as excited about him now that he wasn't courting someone else.
"Things are rocky. Malasha seems like a better prospect."
He moved on quickly.
"I take it that Royon won't soon be going on any plateau assault with us."
Dalinar shook his head.
"He's too afraid that I'm trying to maneuver him into a position where I can seize his lands. Perhaps it was wrong to approach the weakest High Prince first. He'd rather hunker down and try to weather what comes at him, holding what he has, as opposed to making a risky play for something greater."
Dalinar stared at the map, looking distant again.
"Gavilar dreamed of unifying Alethkar. Once I thought he'd achieved it, despite what he claimed. The longer I work with these men, the more I realize that Gavilar was right. We failed. We defeated these men, but we never unified them."
"So you still intend to approach the others?"
"I do. I only need one to say yes in order to start. Who do you think we should go to next?"
"I'm not sure," Adolin said. "But for now I think you should know something. Sadeus has sent to us, asking permission to enter our war camp. He wants to interview the grooms who cared for His Majesty's horse during the hunt."
"His new position gives him the right to make those kinds of demands."
"Father," Adolin said, stepping closer, speaking softly.
"I think he's going to move against us."
Dalinar looked at him.
"I know you trust him," Adolin said quickly, "and I understand your reasons now. But listen to me. This move puts him in an ideal position to undermine us. The king has grown paranoid enough that he's suspicious even of you and me. I know you've seen it. All Sadeus needs to do is find imaginary evidence linking us to an attempt to kill the king, and he'll be able to turn Alethkar against us."
"We may have to risk that."
Adolin frowned.
"But—"
"I trust Sadeus, son," Dalinar said. "But even if I didn't, we couldn't forbid him entry or block his investigation. We'd not only look guilty in the king's eyes, but we'd be denying his authority as well."
He shook his head.
If I ever want the other High Princes to accept me as their leader in war, I have to be willing to allow Sadeus his authority as High Prince of Information. I can't rely upon the old traditions of my authority, yet deny Sadeus the same right.
I suppose, Adolin admitted. But we could still prepare. You can't tell me you're not a little worried.
Dalinar hesitated.
Perhaps. This maneuver of Sadeus's is aggressive. But I've been told what to do. Trust Sadeus. Be strong. Act with honor, and honor will aid you. That is the advice I've been given.
From where?
Dalinar looked to him, and it became obvious to Adolin.
So we're betting the future of our house on these visions now, Adolin said flatly.
I wouldn't say that, Dalinar replied. If Sadeus did move against us, I wouldn't simply let him shove us over. But I'm also not going to make the first move against him.
Because of what you've seen, Adolin said, growing frustrated. Father, you said you'd listen to what I had to say about the visions. But please listen now.
This isn't the proper place.
You always have an excuse, Adolin said. I've tried to approach you about it 5 times now, and you always rebuff me.
Perhaps it's because I know what you'll say, Dalinar said, and I know it won't do any good.
Or perhaps it's because you don't want to be confronted by the truth.
That's enough, Adolin.
No, no, it's not. We're mocked in every one of the war camps. Our authority and reputation diminishes by the day, and you refuse to do anything substantial about it.
Adolin, I will not take this from my son.
But you'll take it from everyone else? Why is that, Father? When others say things about us, you let them. But when Renarin or I take the smallest step toward what you view as being inappropriate, we're immediately chastised. Everyone else can speak lies, but I can't speak the truth. Do your sons mean so little to you?
Dalinar froze, looking as if he'd been slapped.
You aren't well, Father, Adolin continued.
Part of him realized that he had gone too far, that he was speaking too loudly. But it boiled out anyway.
We need to stop tiptoeing around it. You need to stop making up increasingly irrational explanations to reason away your lapses. I know it's hard to accept, but sometimes people get old. Sometimes the mind stops working right. I don't know what's wrong. Maybe it's your guilt over Gavilar's death. That book, the codes, the visions. Maybe they're all attempts to find escape, find redemption, something. What you see is not real. Your life now is a rationalization, a way of trying to pretend that what's happening isn't happening. But I'll go to damnation itself before I'll let you drag the entire house down without speaking my mind on it.
He practically shouted those last words. They echoed in the large chamber, and Adolin realized he was shaking. He had never, in all his years of life, spoken to his father in such a way.
You think I haven't wondered these things? Dalinar said, his voice cold, his eyes hard. I've gone through each point you've made 12 times over.
Then maybe you should go over them a few more.
I must trust myself. The visions are trying to show me something important. I cannot prove it or explain how I know, but it's true.
Of course you think that, Adolin said, exasperated. Don't you see? That's exactly what you would feel. Men are very good at seeing what they want to. Look at the king. He sees a killer in every shadow, and a worn strap becomes a convoluted plot to take his life.
Dalinar fell silent again.
Sometimes the simple answers are the right ones, Father, Adolin said. The king's strap just wore out, and you're seeing things that aren't there. I'm sorry.
They locked expressions. Adolin didn't look away. He wouldn't look away. Dalinar finally turned from him.
Leave me, please.
All right. Fine. But I want you to think about this. I want you to...
Adolin, go!
Adolin gritted his teeth, but turned and stalked away. It needed to be said, he told himself as he left the gallery. That didn't make him feel any less sick about having to be the one who said it.
25. The Butcher. 7 years ago.
"It ain't right what they do," the woman's voice said. "You ain't supposed to cut into folks, peering in to see what the Almighty placed hidden for good reason."
Cal froze, standing in an alleyway between two houses in Hearthstone. The sky was wan overhead. Winter had come for a time. The weeping was near, and high storms were infrequent. For now, it was too cold for plants to enjoy the respite. Rockbuds spent winter weeks curled up inside their shells. Most creatures hibernated, waiting for warmth to return. Fortunately, seasons generally lasted only a few weeks. Unpredictability, that was the way of the world. Only after death was there stability, so the Ardens taught, at least. Cal wore a thick padded coat of beech tree cotton. The material was scratchy but warm, and had been dyed a deep brown. He kept the hood up, his hands in his pockets. To his right sat the baker's place. The family slept in the triangular crawl space in back, and the front was their store. To Cal's left was one of Hearthstone's taverns, where Lavis ale and mud beer flowed in abundance during winter weeks. He could hear two women, unseen but chatting a short distance away.
"You know that he stole from the old city lord," one woman's voice said, keeping her voice down. "An entire goblet full of spheres. The surgeon says they were a gift. But he was the only one there when the city lord died." "There is a document, I hear," the first voice said. "A few glyphs, not a proper will. And whose hand wrote those glyphs? The surgeon himself." "It ain't right, the city lord not having a woman there to be scribe. I'm telling you, it ain't right what they do."
Cal gritted his teeth, tempted to step out and let the woman see that he'd heard them. His father wouldn't approve, though. Liren wouldn't want to cause strife or embarrassment. But that was his father. So Cal marched right out of the alleyway, passing Nana Tereth and Nana Relina, standing and gossiping in front of the bakery. Tereth was the baker's wife, a fat woman with curly dark hair. She was in the middle of another calumny. Cal gave her a sharp look, and her brown eyes showed a satisfying moment of discomfiture. Cal crossed the square carefully, wary of patches of ice. The door to the bakery slammed shut behind him, the two women fleeing inside. His satisfaction didn't last long. Why did people always say such things about his father? They called him morbid and unnatural, but would scurry out to buy glyph wards and charms from a passing apothecary or luck merch. The Almighty pity a man who actually did something useful to help. Still stewing, Cal turned a few corners, walking to where his mother stood on a stepladder at the side of the town hall, carefully chipping at the eaves of the building. Asina was a tall woman, and she usually kept her hair pulled back into a tail, then wrapped a kerchief around her head. Today she wore a knit hat over that. She had a long brown coat that matched Cal's, and the blue hem of her skirt just barely peeked out at the bottom. The objects of her attention were a set of icicle-like pendants of rock that had formed on the edges of the roof. High storms dropped stormwater, and stormwater carried creme. If left alone, creme eventually hardened into stone. Buildings grew stalactites, formed by stormwater slowly dripping from the eaves. You had to clean them off regularly, or risk weighing down the roof so much that it collapsed. She noticed him and smiled, her cheeks flushed from the cold. With a narrow face, a bold chin, and full lips, she was a pretty woman. At least Cal thought so. Prettier than the baker's wife, for sure.
"Your father dismissed you from your lessons already?" she asked. "Everyone hates father," Cal blurted out.
His mother turned back to her work.
"Kaladin, you're 13. You're old enough to know not to say foolish things like that." "It's true," he said stubbornly. "I heard some women talking just now. They said that father stole the spheres from Bright Lord Wistio. They say that father enjoys slicing people open and doing things that ain't natural."
"Aren't natural."
"Why can't I speak like everyone else?"
because it isn't proper. It's proper enough for Nana Tarith.
And what do you think of her? Cal hesitated.
She's ignorant, and she likes to gossip about things she doesn't know anything about.
Well then, if you wish to emulate her, I can obviously find no objection to the practice.
Cal grimaced. You had to watch yourself when speaking with Hesina. She liked to twist words about. He leaned back against the wall of the town hall, watching his breath puff out in front of him. Perhaps a different tactic would work.
Mother, why do people hate Father?
They don't hate him, she said. However, his calmly asked question got her to continue. But he does make them uncomfortable.
Why?
Because some people are frightened of knowledge. Your father is a learned man. He knows things the others can't understand. So those things must be dark and mysterious. They aren't afraid of luck merches and glyph wards.
Those you can understand, her mother said calmly. You burn a glyph ward out in front of your house, and it will turn away evil. It's easy. Your father won't give someone a ward to heal them. He'll insist that they stay in bed, drinking water, taking some foul medicine, and washing their wound each day. It's hard. They'd rather leave it all to fate.
Cal considered that.
I think they hate him because he fails too often.
There is that. If a glyph ward fails, you can blame it on the will of the Almighty. If your father fails, then it's his fault.
Or such is the perception. His mother continued working, flakes of stone falling to the ground around her.
They'll never actually hate your father. He's too useful. But he'll never really be one of them. That's the price of being a surgeon. Having power over the lives of men is an uncomfortable responsibility.
And if I don't want that responsibility? What if I just want to be something normal, like a baker or a farmer or...
Or a soldier, he added in his mind. He'd picked up a staff a few times in secret, and though he'd never been able to replicate that moment when he'd fought Jost, there was something invigorating about holding a weapon, something that drew him and excited him.
I think, his mother said, that you'll find the lives of bakers and farmers are not so enviable.
At least they have friends.
And so do you.
What of Tien?
Tien's not a friend, mother, he's my brother.
Oh, and he can't be both at once?
Cal rolled his eyes.
You know what I mean.
She climbed down from the stepladder, patting his shoulder.
Yes, I do. And I'm sorry to make light of it.
But you put yourself in a difficult position. You want friends, but do you really want to act like the other boys? Give up your studies so you can slave in the fields? Grow old before your time, weathered and furrowed by the sun?
Cal didn't reply.
The things that others have always seem better than what you have, his mother said. Bring the stepladder.
Cal followed dutifully, rounding the town hall to the other side, then putting down the ladder so his mother could climb up to begin work again.
The others think Father stole those spheres.
Cal shoved his hands in his pockets.
They think he wrote out that order from Bright Lord Wistio and had the old man sign it when he didn't know what he was doing.
His mother was silent.
I hate their lies and gossip, Cal said. I hate them for making up things about us.
Don't hate them, Cal. They're good people. In this case, they're just repeating what they've heard.
She glanced at the city lord's manor, distant upon a hill above the town. Every time Cal saw it, he felt like he should go up and talk to Laurel. But the last few times he'd tried, he hadn't been allowed to see her. Now that her father was dead, her nurse oversaw her time, and the woman didn't think mingling with boys from the town was appropriate. The nurse's husband, Myliv, had been Bright Lord Wistio's head steward. If there was a source of bad rumors about Cal's family, it probably came from him. He never had liked Cal's father. Well, Myliv wouldn't matter soon. A new city lord was expected to arrive any day.
Mother, Cal said, those spheres are just sitting there doing nothing but glowing.
Can't we spend some to keep you from having to come out here and work?
I like working, she said, scraping away again. It clears the head.
Didn't you just tell me that I wouldn't like having to labor? My face furrowed before its time, or something poetic like that?
She hesitated, then laughed.
Clever boy.
Cold boy, he grumbled, shivering.
I work because I want to. We can't spend those spheres, they're for your education. And so my working is better than forcing your father to charge for his healings.
Maybe they'd respect us more if we did charge.
Oh, they respect us.
No, I don't think that is the problem. She looked down at Cal.
You know that we're second none.
Sure, Cal said, shrugging. An accomplished young surgeon of the right rank could draw the attention of a poorer noble family, one who wished money and acclaim. It happens in the larger cities.
Cal glanced up at the mansion again.
That's why you encouraged me to play with Laurel so much. You wanted to marry me off to her, didn't you?
It was a possibility, his mother said, returning to her work.
He honestly wasn't certain how he felt about that. The last few months had been strange for Cal. His father had forced him into his studies, but in secret he'd spent his time with the staff. Two possible paths. Both enticing. Cal did like learning, and he longed for the ability to help people, bind their wounds, make them better. He saw true nobility in what his father did. But it seemed to Cal that if he could fight, he could do something even more noble. Protect their lands, like the great light-eyed heroes of the stories. And there was the way he felt when holding a weapon. Two paths. Opposites in many ways. He could only choose one. His mother kept chipping away at the eaves, and, with a sigh, Cal fetched a second step ladder and set of tools from the workroom, then joined her. He was tall for his age, but he still had to stand high on the ladder. He caught his mother smiling as he worked, no doubt pleased at having raised such a helpful young man. In reality, Cal just wanted the chance to pound on something. How would he feel, marrying someone like Laurel? He'd never be her equal. Their children would have a chance of being light-eyed or dark-eyed, so even his children might outrank him. He knew he'd feel terribly out of place. That was another aspect of becoming a surgeon. If he chose that path, he would be choosing the life of his father, choosing to set himself apart, to be isolated. If he went to war, however, he would have a place. Maybe he could even do the nearly unthinkable, win a shard blade and become a true light eyes. Then he could marry Laurel and not have to be her inferior. Was that why she'd always encouraged him to become a soldier? Had she been thinking about those kinds of things even back then? Back then, these kinds of decisions, marriage, his future, had seemed impossibly far off to Cal. He felt so young. Did he really have to consider these questions? It would still be another few years before the surgeons of Carbranth would let him take their tests. But if he were going to become a soldier instead, he'd have to join the army before that happened. How would his father react if Cal just up and went with the recruiters? Cal wasn't certain he'd be able to face Liren's disappointed eyes. As if in response to his thoughts, Liren's voice called from nearby.
Hesina?
Cal's mother turned, smiling and tucking a stray lock of dark hair back into her kerchief. Cal's father rushed down the street, his face anxious. Cal felt a sudden jolt of worry. Who was wounded? Why hadn't Liren sent for him?
What is it?
Cal's mother asked, climbing down.
He's here, Hesina,
Cal's father said.
About time.
Who?
Cal asked, jumping down from the stepladder.
Who's here?
The new city lord's son, Liren said, his breath puffing in the cold air. His name is Bright Lord Roshon. No time to change, I'm afraid. Not if you want to catch his first speech. Come on.
The three of them hurried away, Cal's thoughts and worries banished in the face of the chance to meet a new light eyes.
He didn't send word ahead, Liren said under his breath.
That could be a good sign,
Hesina replied. Maybe he doesn't feel he needs everyone to dote on him.
That, or he's inconsiderate.
Stormfather, I hate getting a new landed. Always makes me feel like I'm throwing a handful of stones into a game of breakneck. Will we throw the queen or the tower?
We shall see soon enough, Hesina said, glancing at Cal.
Don't let your father's words unnerve you. He always gets pessimistic at times like this.
I do not, Liren said. She gave him a look. Name one other time.
Meeting my parents?
Cal's father pulled up short, blinking.
Storm winds, he muttered.
Let's hope this doesn't go half as poorly as that. Cal listened with curiosity. He'd never met his mother's parents. They weren't often spoken of. Soon, the three of them reached the south side of town. A crowd was gathered, and Tien was already there, waiting. He waved in his excitable way, jumping up and down.
Wish I had half that boy's energy, Liren said.
I've got a place for us picked out, Tien called eagerly, pointing. By the rain barrels. Come on, we're going to miss it.
Tien scurried over, climbing atop the barrels. Several of the town's other boys noticed him, and they nudged one another, one making some comment Cal couldn't hear. It set the others laughing at Tien, and that immediately made Cal furious. Tien didn't deserve mockery just because he was a little small for his age. This wasn't a good time to confront the other boys, though, so Cal sullenly joined his parents beside the barrels. Tien smiled at him, standing atop his barrel. He'd piled a few of his favorite rocks near him, stones of different colors and shapes. There were rocks all around them, and yet Tien was the only person he knew who found wonder in them. After a moment's consideration, Cal climbed atop a barrel, careful not to disturb any of Tien's rocks, so he too could get a better view of the city lord's procession. It was enormous. There must have been a dozen wagons in that line, following a fine black carriage pulled by four sleek black horses. Cal gawked, despite himself. Wistio had only owned one horse, and it had seemed as old as he was. Could one man, even a Light-Eyes, own that much furniture? Where would he put it all? And there were people, too. Dozens of them, riding in the wagons, walking in groups. There were also a dozen soldiers in gleaming breastplates and leather skirts. This Light-Eyes even had his own honor guard. Eventually, the procession reached the turnoff to Hearthstone. A man riding a horse led the carriage and its soldiers forward to the town while most of the wagons continued up to the manor. Cal grew increasingly excited as the carriage rolled slowly into place. Would he finally get to see a real Light-Eyed hero? The word around town claimed it was likely that the new city lord would be someone King Gavilar or High Prince Sadeus had promoted because he'd distinguished himself in the wars to unite Alethkar. The carriage turned sideways so that the door faced the crowd. The horses snorted and stomped the ground, and the carriage driver hopped down and quickly opened the door. A middle-aged man with a short, gray-streaked beard stepped out. He wore a ruffled violet coat, tailored so that it was short at the front, reaching only to his waist, but long at the back. Beneath it he wore a golden takama, a long straight skirt that went down to his calves. A takama. Few wore them anymore, but old soldiers in town spoke of the days when they'd been popular as warrior's garb. Cal hadn't expected the takama to look so much like a woman's skirt, but still it was a good sign. Rishon himself seemed a little too old, a little too flabby to be a true soldier, but he wore a sword. The Light-Eyed man scanned the crowd, a distasteful look on his face, as if he'd swallowed something bitter. Behind the man, two people peeked out, a younger man with a narrow face, and an older woman with braided hair. Rishon studied the crowd, then shook his head and turned around to climb back in the carriage. Cal frowned. Wasn't he going to say anything? The crowd seemed to share Cal's shock. A few of them began whispering in anxiety.
Bright Lord Rishon, Cal's father called.
The crowd hushed. The Light-Eyed man glanced back. People shied away, and Cal found himself shrinking down beneath that harsh gaze.
Who spoke?
Rishon demanded, his voice a low baritone. Liren stepped forward, raising a hand.
Bright Lord, was your trip pleasant? Please, can we show you the town?
What is your name?
Liren, Bright Lord. Hearthstone's surgeon.
Ah, Rishon said. You're the one who let old Wistio die.
The Bright Lord's expression darkened.
In a way, it's your fault I'm in this pitiful, miserable quarter of the kingdom.
He grunted, then climbed back in the carriage and slammed the door. Within seconds, the carriage driver had replaced the stairs, climbed into his place, and started turning the vehicle around. Cal's father slowly let his arm fall to his side. The townspeople began to chatter immediately, gossiping about the soldiers, the carriage, the horses. Cal sat down on his barrel.
Well, he thought, I guess we could expect a warrior to be curt, right?
The heroes from the legends weren't necessarily the polite types. Killing people and fancy talking didn't always go together, old Jarl had once told him. Liren walked back, his expression troubled.
Well,
Asena said, trying to sound cheerful.
What do you think? Did we throw the queen or the tower?
Neither.
Oh? And what did we throw instead?
I'm not sure, he said, glancing over his shoulder. A pair and a trio, maybe. Let's get back home.
Tian scratched his head in confusion, but the words weighed on Cal. The tower was three pairs in a game of breakneck. The queen was two trios. The first was an outright loss, the other an outright win. But a pair and a trio, that was called the butcher. Whether you won or not would depend on the other throws you made. And more importantly, on the throws of everyone else. Twenty-six. Stillness. I am being chased. Your friends of the 17th Shard, I suspect. I believe they're still lost, following a false trail I left for them. They'll be happier that way. I doubt they have any inkling what to do with me should they actually catch me.
I stood in the darkened monastery chamber, Litima read, standing at the lectern with the tome open before her. Its far reaches painted with pools of black where light did not wander. I sat on the floor thinking of that dark, that unseen. I could not know for certain what was hidden in that night. I suspected there were walls, sturdy and thick. But could I know without seeing? When all was hidden, what could a man rely upon as true?
Litima, one of Dalinar's scribes, was tall and plump, and wore a violet silk gown with yellow trim. She read to Dalinar as he stood regarding the maps on the wall of his sitting room. That room was fitted with handsome wood furnishings and fine woven rugs imported up from Marat. A crystal carafe of afternoon wine, orange, not intoxicating, sat on a high-legged serving table in the corner, sparkling with the light of the diamond spheres hanging in chandeliers above.
Candle flames,
Litima continued. The selection was from The Way of Kings, read from the very copy that Gavilar had once owned.
A dozen candles burned themselves to death on the shelf before me. Each of my breaths made them tremble. To them I was a behemoth, to frighten and destroy. And yet if I strayed too close, they could destroy me. My invisible breath, the pulses of life that flowed in and out, could end them freely, while my fingers could not do the same without being repaid in pain.
Dalinar idly twisted his signet ring in thought. It was sapphire with his Colin glyph pair on it. Renarin stood next to him, wearing a coat of blue and silver, golden knobs on the shoulders marking him as a prince. Adolin wasn't there. Dalinar and he had been stepping gingerly around one another since their argument in the gallery.
I understood in a moment of stillness, Litima read. Those candle flames were like the lives of men, so fragile, so deadly. Left alone, they lit and warmed. Let run rampant, they would destroy the very things they were meant to illuminate. Embryonic bonfires, each bearing a seed of destruction so potent it could tumble cities and dash kings to their knees. In later years, my mind would return to that calm, silent evening, when I had stared at rows of living lights. And I would understand. To be given loyalty is to be infused like a gemstone, to be granted the frightful license to destroy not only oneself, but all within one's care. Littimer fell still. It was the end of the sequence.
Thank you, Brightness Littimer, Dalinar said. That will do.
The woman bowed her head respectfully. She gathered her youthful ward from the side of the room, and they withdrew, leaving the book on the lectern. That sequence had become one of Dalinar's favorites. Listening to it often comforted him. Someone else had known, someone else had understood how he felt. But today it didn't bring the solace it usually did. It only reminded him of Adolin's arguments. None had been things Dalinar hadn't considered himself, but being confronted with them by someone he trusted had shaken everything. He found himself staring at his maps, smaller copies of those that hung in the gallery. They had been recreated for him by the royal cartographer, Isasek Shulin. What if Dalinar's visions really were just phantasms? He'd often longed for the glory days of Alethkar's past. Were the visions his mind's answer to that? A subconscious way of letting himself be a hero? Of giving himself justification for doggedly seeking his goals? A disturbing thought. Looked at another way, those phantom commands to unify sounded a great deal like what the Hierocracy had said when it had tried to conquer the world 5 centuries before. Dalinar turned from his maps and walked across the room, his booted feet falling on a soft rug. Too nice a rug. He'd spent the better part of his life in one war camp or another. He'd slept in wagons, stone barracks, and tents pulled tight against the leeward side of stone formations. Compared with that, his present dwelling was practically a mansion. He felt as if he should cast out all of this finery. But what would that accomplish? He stopped at the lectern and ran his fingers along the thick pages filled with lines in violet ink. He couldn't read the words, but he could almost feel them, emanating from the page like stormlight from a sphere. Were the words of this book the cause of his problems? The visions had started several months after he'd first listened to readings from it. He rested his hand on the cold, ink-filled pages. Their homeland was stressed nearly to breaking. The war was stalled, and suddenly he found himself captivated by the very ideals and myths that had led to his brother's downfall. This was a time the Alethi needed the Blackthorn, not an old, tired soldier who fancied himself a philosopher. Blast it all, he thought. I thought I'd figured this out. He closed the leather-bound volume, the spine crackling. He carried it to the bookshelf and returned it to its place. Father, Renarin asked, is there something I can do for you?
I wish there were, son.
Dalinar tapped the spine of the book lightly.
It's ironic. This book was once considered one of the great masterpieces of political philosophy. Did you know that? Yasna told me that kings around the world used to study it daily. Now it's considered borderline blasphemous.
Renarin gave no reply.
Regardless, Dalinar said, walking back to the wall map. High Prince Aladar refused my offer of an alliance, just as Royan did. Do you have a thought on whom I should approach next?
Adolin says we should be far more worried about Sadeus's ploy to destroy us than we are.
The room fell silent. Renarin had a habit of doing that, felling conversations like an enemy archer hunting officers on the battlefield.
Your brother is right to worry, Dalinar said. But moving against Sadeus would undermine Alethkar as a kingdom.
for the same reason Sadeus won't risk acting against us. He'll see.
I hope.
Horns suddenly sounded outside, their deep, resounding calls echoing. Dalinar and Renarin froze. Parshendi spotted on the plains. A second set came. 23rd Plateau of the Second Quadrant. Dalinar's scouts thought the contested plateau close enough for their forces to reach first. Dalinar dashed across the room, all other thoughts discarded for the moment, his booted feet thumping on the thick rug. He threw open the door and charged down the stormlight-illuminated hallway. The war room door was open, and Taleb, high officer on duty, saluted as Dalinar entered. Taleb was a straight-backed man with light green eyes. He kept his hair long in a braid, and had a blue tattoo on his cheek, marking him as an old blood. At the side of the room, his wife, Calamy, sat behind a long-legged desk on a high stool. She wore her dark hair with only two small side braids pinned up, the rest hanging down the back of her violet dress to brush the top of the stool. She was a historian of note, and had requested permission to record meetings like this one. She planned to scribe a history of the war.
"Sir,"
Taleb said,
"a chasm fiend crawled atop the plateau here less than a quarter hour ago."
He pointed to the battle map, which had glyphs marking each plateau. Dalinar stepped up to it, a group of his officers gathering around him.
"How far would you say that is?" Dalinar asked, rubbing his chin.
"Perhaps 2 hours," Taleb said,
indicating a route one of his men had drawn on the map.
"Sir, I think we have a good chance at this one. Bright Lord Aladar will have to traverse 6 unclaimed plateaus to reach the contested area, but we have a nearly direct line. Bright Lord Sadeus would have trouble, as he'd have to work his way around several large chasms too wide to cross with bridges. I'll bet he won't even try for it."
Dalinar did indeed have the most direct line. He hesitated, though. It had been months since he'd last gone on a plateau run. His attention had been diverted, his troops needed for protecting roadways and patrolling the large markets that had grown up outside the war camps. And now Adolin's questions weighed upon him, pressing him down. It seemed like a terrible time to go out to battle.
"No," he thought. "No, I need to do this."
Winning a plateau skirmish would do much for his troops' morale, and would help discredit the rumors in camp.
"We march," Dalinar declared.
A few of the officers whooped in excitement, an extreme show of emotion for the normally reserved Alethi.
"And your son, Bright Lord?" Taleb asked.
He'd heard of the confrontation between them. Dalinar doubted there was a person in all 10 war camps who hadn't heard of it.
"Send for him," Dalinar said firmly.
Adolin probably needed this as much as, or more than, Dalinar did. The officers scattered. Dalinar's armor-bearers entered a moment later. It had only been a few minutes since the horns had sounded, but after 6 years of fighting, the machine of war ran smoothly when battle called. From outside, he heard the horn's third set begin, calling his forces to battle. The armor-bearers inspected his boots, checking to be certain the laces were tight, then brought a long padded vest to throw over his uniform. Next, they set the sabaton, armor for his boots, on the floor before him. They encased his boots entirely, and had a rough surface on the bottoms that seemed to cling to rock. The interiors glowed with the light of the sapphires in their indented pockets. Dalinar was reminded of his most recent vision. The radiant, his armor glowing with glyphs. Modern shardplate didn't glow like that. Could his mind have fabricated that detail? Would it have?
"No time to consider that now," he thought.
He discarded his uncertainties and worries, something he'd learned to do during his first battles as a youth. A warrior needed to be focused. Adolin's questions would still be waiting for him when he got back. For now, he couldn't afford self-doubt or uncertainty. It was time to be the Blackthorn. He stepped into the sabaton, and the straps tightened of their own accord, fitting around his boots. The greaves came next, going over his legs and knees, locking onto the sabaton. Shardplate wasn't like ordinary armor. There was no mesh of steel mail and no leather straps at the joints. Shardplate seams were made of smaller plates, interlocking, overlapping, incredibly intricate, leaving no vulnerable gaps. There was very little rubbing or chafing. Each piece fit together perfectly, as if it had been crafted specifically for Dalinar. One always put the armor on from the feet upward. Shard plate was extremely heavy. Without the enhanced strength it provided, no man would be able to fight in it. Dalinar stood still as the armor-bearers affixed the cuisses over his thighs and locked them to the culottes and folds across his waist and lower back. A skirt made of small interlocking plates came next, reaching down to just above the knees.
"Bright Lord," Taleb said, stepping up to him. "Have you given thought to my suggestion about the bridges?"
"You know how I feel about man-carried bridges, Taleb," Dalinar said as the armor-bearers locked his breastplate into place, then worked on the rear braces and vam braces for his arms. Already he could feel the strength of the plate surging through him.
"We wouldn't have to use the smaller bridges for the assault," Taleb said, "just for getting to the contested plateau."
"We'd still have to bring the Chelpuld bridges to get across that last chasm," Dalinar said. "I'm not convinced that bridge crews would move us any more quickly. Not when we have to wait for those animals."
Taleb sighed. Dalinar reconsidered. A good officer was one who accepted orders and fulfilled them, even when he disagreed. But the mark of a great officer was that he also tried to innovate and offer appropriate suggestions.
"You may recruit and train a single bridge crew," Dalinar said. "We shall see. In these races, even a few minutes can be meaningful."
Taleb smiled.
"Thank you, sir."
Dalinar waved with his left hand as the armor-bearers locked the gauntlet onto his right. He made a fist, tiny plates curving perfectly. The left gauntlet followed. Then the gorget went over his head, covering his neck, the pauldrons on his shoulders, and the helm on his head. Finally, the armor-bearers affixed his cape to the pauldrons. Dalinar took a deep breath, feeling the thrill build for the approaching battle. He strode from the war room, footfalls firm and solid. Attendants and servants scattered before him, making way. Wearing shard plate again after a long period without was like waking up after a night of feeling groggy or disoriented. The spring of the step, the impetus the armor seemed to lend him, made him want to race down the hallway and... And why not? He broke into a sprint. Taleb and the others cried out in surprise, rushing to keep up. Dalinar outpaced them easily, reaching the front gates of the complex and leaping through, throwing himself off the long steps leading down from his enclave. He exulted, grinning as he hung in the air, then slammed to the ground. The force cracked the stone beneath him, and he crouched into the impact. Before him, neat rows of barracks ran through his war camp, formed in radials, with a meeting ground and mess hall at the center of each battalion. His officers reached the top of the stairs, looking down with amazement. Renarin was with them, wearing his uniform that had never seen battle, his hand raised against the sunlight. Dalinar felt foolish. Was he a youth just given his first taste of shard plate?
Back to work. Stop playing.
Parathom, his infantry lord, saluted as Dalinar strode up.
"Second and third battalions are on duty today, Bright Lord, forming ranks to march." "First bridge squad is gathered, Bright Lord,"
Havara, the bridge lord, said, striding up. He was a short man with some Herdazian blood in him, as evidenced by his dark, crystalline fingernails, though he didn't wear a spark flicker.
"I have word from Ashalem that the archery company is ready."
"Cavalry?"
Dalinar asked.
"And where is my son?"
"Here, father,"
called a familiar voice. Adolin, his shard plate painted a deep Colin blue, made his way through the gathering crowd. His visor was up, and he looked eager, but when he met Dalinar's eyes, he glanced away immediately. Dalinar held up a hand, quieting several officers who were trying to give him reports. He strode to Adolin, and the youth looked up, meeting his gaze.
"You said what you felt you must," Dalinar said.
"And I'm not sorry I did," Adolin replied. "But I am sorry for how and where I said it. That won't happen again."
Dalinar nodded, and that was enough. Adolin seemed to relax, a weight coming off his shoulders, and Dalinar turned back to his officers. In moments, he and Adolin were leading a hurried group to the staging area. As they did, Dalinar did note Adolin waving to a young woman who stood beside the way, wearing a red dress, her hair up in a very nice braiding.
"Is that, Milasha?"
Adolin said. "Yes."
"She looks nice."
"Most of the time she is, though she's somewhat annoyed that I wouldn't let her come with me today."
"She wanted to come into battle?"
Adolin shrugged. "Says she's curious." Dalinar said nothing. Battle was a masculine art. A woman wanting to come to the battlefield was like, well, like a man wanting to read. Unnatural. Ahead, in the staging area, the battalions were forming ranks, and a squat, light-eyed officer hurried up to Dalinar. He had patches of red hair on his otherwise dark Alethi head, and a long red mustache. Ilamar, the cavalry lord.
"Bright Lord," he said, "my apologies for the delay. Cavalry is mounted and ready."
"We march, then," Dalinar said. "All ranks."
"Bright Lord,"
a voice said. Dalinar turned as one of his messengers approached. The dark-eyed man wore leathers marked with blue bands on his arms. He saluted, saying,
"High Prince Sadius has demanded admittance to the war camp."
Dalinar glanced at Adolin. His son's expression darkened.
"He claims the king's writ of investigation grants him the right," the messenger said.
"Admit him," Dalinar said.
"Yes, Bright Lord,"
the messenger said, turning back. One of the lesser officers, Moratel, went with him so that Sadius could be welcomed and escorted by a light eyes as befitted his station. Moratel was least among those in attendance. Everyone understood he was the one Dalinar would send.
"What do you think Sadius wants this time?" Dalinar said quietly to Adolin.
"Our blood. Preferably warm, perhaps sweetened with a shot of Talu brandy." Dalinar grimaced, and the two of them hurried past the ranks of soldiers. The men had an air of anticipation, spears held high, dark-eyed citizen officers standing at the sides with axes on their shoulders. At the front of the force, a group of chulls snorted and rummaged at the rocks by their feet. Harnessed to them were several enormous mobile bridges. Gallant and Adolin's white stallion Sureblood were waiting, their reins held at the ready by grooms. Rashadium hardly needed handlers. Once Gallant had kicked open his stall and made his way to the staging grounds on his own when a groom had been too slow. Dalinar patted the midnight destrier on the neck, then swung into the saddle. He scanned the staging field, then raised his arm to give the command to move. However, he noticed a group of mounted men riding up to the staging field, led by a figure in dark red shard plate. Sadius. Dalinar stifled a sigh and gave the command to move out, though he himself waited for the High Prince of Information. Adolin came over on Sureblood, and he gave Dalinar a glance that seemed to say, "Don't worry, I'll behave." As always, Sadius was a model of fashion. His armor painted, his helm ornamented with a completely different metallic pattern than he had worn last time. This one was shaped like a stylized sunburst. It looked almost like a crown.
"Bright Lord Sadius," Dalinar said, "this is an inconvenient time for your investigation."
"Unfortunately," Sadius said, reining in. "His Majesty is very eager to have answers, and I cannot stop my investigation, even for a plateau assault. I need to interview some of your soldiers. I'll do it on the way out."
"You want to come with us?"
"Why not? I won't delay you."
He glanced at the chulls, who lurched into motion, pulling the bulky bridges.
"I doubt that even were I to decide to crawl, I could slow you any further."
"Our soldiers need to concentrate on the upcoming battle, Bright Lord," Adolin said. "They should not be distracted."
"The king's will must be done,"
Sadius said, shrugging, not even bothering to look at Adolin.
"Need I present the writ? Surely you don't intend to forbid me?"
Dalinar studied his former friend, looking into those eyes, trying to see into the man's soul. Sadius lacked his characteristic smirk. He usually wore one of those when he was pleased with how a plot was going. Did he realize that Dalinar knew how to read his expressions, and so masked his emotions,
No need to present anything, Sadius. My men are at your disposal. If you have need of anything, simply ask. Adolin, with me.
Dalinar turned gallant and galloped down the line toward the front of the marching army. Adolin followed reluctantly, and Sadius remained behind with his attendants. The long ride began. The permanent bridges here were Dalinar's, maintained and guarded by his soldiers and scouts, connecting plateaus that he controlled. Sadius spent the trip riding near the middle of the column of 2,000. He periodically sent an attendant to pull certain soldiers out of line. Dalinar spent the ride mentally preparing himself for the battle ahead. He spoke with his officers about the layout of the plateau, got a report on where specifically the Chasm Fiend had chosen to make its chrysalis, and sent scouts ahead to watch for Parshendi. Those scouts carried their long poles to get them from plateau to plateau, without bridges. Dalinar's force eventually reached the end of the permanent bridges, and had to start waiting for the Chul bridges to be lowered across the chasms. The big machines were built like siege towers with enormous wheels, and armored sections at the side where soldiers could push. At a chasm, they unhooked the Chuls, pushed the machine forward by hand, and ratcheted a crank at the back to lower the bridge. Once the bridge was set down, the machinery was unlocked and pulled across. The bridge was built so they could lock the machine onto the other side, pull the bridge up, then turn and hook the Chuls up again. It was a slow process. Dalinar watched from horseback, fingers tapping the side of his hogshide saddle as the first chasm was spanned. Perhaps Taleb was right. Could they use lighter, more portable bridges to get across these early chasms, then resort to the siege bridges only for the final assault? A clatter of hooves on rock announced someone riding up the side of the column. Dalinar turned, expecting Adolin, and instead found Sadius. Why had Sadius asked to be High Prince of Information, and why was he so dogged in pursuing this matter of the broken girth? If he did decide to create some kind of false implication of Dalinar's guilt...